Hey everybody, how are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thanks so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. We are thrilled and delighted to bring our next guest on the show, a returning visitor, a composer of the highest merit. David Fleming does spy movies, he does Deep South movies, and now he can add fantasy to the genres, which he adds to his resume at a staggering pace, including Dune 2. You got a lot going on there, David. So great to see you again. Today's funny enough, today's word of the day is cacophony, a harsh discordance of sound. If you wanted that, David is not your cup of tea. David makes music and it's beautiful, it sings, it's triumphant, and the swells just, oh, it eats your heart away. So David, thank you for coming back to the show. How are things in your world?
Oh my God, thank you. Thanks for having me. And I don't know that I would agree with that. I think I'm extremely capable of cacophony and cacophonous noise. Definitely in my arsenal for sure. But I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, swell. The year is off to a pretty good start. I mean, I think that people are back in cinemas, people are living and breathing, you know, live music. I think that there's so much content out there, and no matter where you go, whether it's Mr. and Mrs. Smith or Damsel on Netflix or Dune 2, I mean, there's so much great content. It's kind of like, maybe you can relate to this. I remember being on an airplane probably about 10 years ago, and it would take me a third of the flight to figure out what I wanted to watch. And by the time I started something, they were like, please put your seats in the upright and locked position. We'll be landing. I'm like, son of a bitch. So,
yeah. Choice paralysis. I can identify sometimes. It's just easier to just go to bed. I think there is good stuff and hopefully a trend for the better. It's been interesting to sort of go through both COVID and the strike that we just had and see how it affects, you know, the overall output. So, you know, you never know until you're far past, you know, the time you're living through, you know, what kind of an era it really is, and if the arts are getting better or worse. But I like to think they're changing for the better, so we'll see.
And sound quality too. I mean, I remember being in a Look cinema when Stuart Bowling, I think he was one of the founders of Dolby Atmos, was exhibiting what Dolby Atmos could do. We were watching Oblivion, right. And it was like, and now you can get it on your phone. And I just don't understand how granular sound can be to the point where, you know, if you're in a theater, there's the idea that you have 160 audio points of reference, and you can get the same thing through what I would perceive as two channels through your headphones. Like, how do they prepare you for that level of, you know, engineering and science when you're learning to compose and working you know, with other great composers and musicians?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing what they can do now, and that the translation between an Atmos or IMAX theater and the iPhone can be, obviously you'd prefer people, you know, consume your work in as best a setting as possible, you know. But like, for instance, with Damsel, most people are going to watch at home. It's Netflix. I mean, everyone's going to watch at home, but you know, most people, maybe some will watch in a home theater, maybe some are going to watch on your phone. And then you have Dune, which is, you know, getting people out to the cinemas in large numbers. And I mean, it's luckily there's smarter people than me to figure out how that sound translation works. But it was interesting, especially in the first Dune, going through the which I also worked on with Hans and as part of his team, just to see, you know, especially when we were doing the soundtrack, we made this sketchbook soundtrack after the film, and like it was so funny because a lot of it we were experimenting with binaural sound, which is effectively like it's stereo image. But how do we make it sound like it's all around you? Basically trying to fake surround sound with stereo illusions. And right when we were sort of finalizing the project, Dolby announced that they were going to start providing Atmos support to Apple, for you know, consumer use and headphone use, and we like right at the last minute started trying to remix the entire album and undo all these illusions that we had done and redo them for object based sort of surround sound. And I have to say, like, the mix team, Alan and Ava and Mark Wary were really like on the cutting edge of what was going to be the standard. But at that time, like, some Dolby knew somewhat, Apple knew somewhat. They were really trying to figure it out. Meanwhile, we were trying to finalize this album. So it was amazing to sort of learn about the Atmos system and how in depth it is through that process. And now having mixed several scores in Atmos, I mean, even Damsel was mixed in Atmos. The main thing you hope is that the music, the story, they can communicate well enough in any delivery system, you know, because you want it to reach as many people as possible. So if that means sounding decent on an iPhone and you know, hopefully the melodies can carry through and communicate.
I don't know. Baseball existed centuries later in the world of Damsel, but whatever sport they played, you hit it out of the park. I mean, I just want to jump into it if that's okay with you. I mean, you've got, you know.
Yeah, please.
I would imagine that every composer wants to do a theme, you know, like it's got to be something that grabs you. You can't wait till like the last third to pull out all the fireworks. But I mean, even something like Elodie's Maze, I mean, 3 minutes in and it is this flurry of, you know, it just feels badass because it kind of hints at what the story is going to be. But I mean, there's a point at about the 3 minute mark where the strings just complement each other and compound to get bigger. And it's amazing. And so I know that, you know, you mentioned the sketchbook and going back to what Hans did for Man of Steel, and he did a sketchbook and the composer do that. So how long does it take to craft these ideas that, you know, either revisit or get bigger or reprise, or if that's even the right word?
Yeah, I mean, as long as they will allow you to, you know, one of the things that I've tried to glean from Hans is to spend as much time in that sort of conceptual phase as you possibly can. In fact, sometimes, you know, Hans will really push that to the limits of, like, especially on films that I've worked on with him, that, you know, it's like, you know, the schedule is looming and he loves to sort of keep the laboratory door, you know, open or closed, so to speak, so that he still wants to conceptualize. So it is a little bit of a game of chicken that you have to play with the schedule and when you actually have to finish the score, because to tell you the truth, the more time you can spend getting really solid musical identities, the faster the scoring process hopefully will go, because you'll have such a strong identity established. So you know, with things like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, that was sort of run and gun and very short amount of time, so sort of the conceptualizing had to happen simultaneously with the execution. But on Damsel, I spent the first month or so on just suites and getting maybe even more than that, just getting the identities right and the melodies right, and felt like I had some sort of roadmap to work with. Of course, things always change as you're actually applying them to picture and seeing what sticks, but it's a process that's extremely important to me. It's just sometimes you don't have as much time as you'd like. On Damsel, I definitely can't complain about time. I had a good amount of time to sort of be in that world and really sort of try to define it.
Well, let's go back to that word you use, roadmap. I think that you can interpret that a lot of ways. That's either the roadmap that David Fleming uses, or maybe the expectation of what could be called fantasy versus, you know, how much director influence there is. So, I mean, people come to you because of your skill. You know, whose roadmap is it?
Well, I think in the best case scenario, it's a collaborative thing that you put together with the director and the other filmmakers. But and in this case, I will say that, especially when concerning the sort of the orchestral nature of it, so much of that is owed to the director, Juan Carlos, who, before I talked to, I was led to believe that, you know, I knew it was going to be his sort of upside down take on a fairy tale and an upside down take on a damsel in distress, and that there was going to be a little bit of subverting of genre expectations and things like that. And I sort of expected that that would apply to the music as well. And maybe he was going to want to do something very modern and a bit ironic, considering the history of the fantasy genre and all of that. But, you know, when I finally had a meeting with him to see if we were the right fit, I was so sort of pleasantly surprised to hear that he, you know, he just talked about how much he loved the orchestra and how much he thought, you know, we really needed a thematic score and something timeless. And you know, I think it ended up being a good decision. I think to, you know, with all of the sort of subverting that was already happening, to have the music play Elodie sincerely and to not try to be winking at the audience or being too cool for school. And because I think fantasy by its nature is sincere and needs to be in order to kind of you know, provide that escape that you can just like lose yourself in. So I was thrilled that you know, in today's landscape, it feels like so many movies are trying to subvert the expectations in every single way, bending over backwards, including the music. And so in a way, both for me and kind of these types of movies recently, it felt like kind of a radical approach to be more sincere and symphonic and traditional with it, and to be sort of unabashedly thematic. And so it was something that I embraced. And of course, yeah, when I it's the score that a 12-year-old me would have like died to get to do this and record that orchestra and that choir. So I had fun the whole way, but it's all really thanks to Juan Carlos and his vision and really his sort of courage at embracing the power that music could lend to his film and not being afraid of it, which often can happen.
Well, 12-year-old you just made your own Willow, so I'm going to give you a round of applause. And going the route of the orchestra is going to fare a lot better in time than, say, I don't know, Lady Hawk, but that's a deep cut there. What I do love are the certain elements that make composers' scores unique. And I think that I'm curious, what inflections, what do you do that maybe, you know, somebody might make a right turn here, but David Fleming decides to go left? And I'm asking specifically about, there's some vocals and chanting in tracks like Horizon, The Dress, and Roses in Ritual. And they actually, it's not that they telegraph what's going to happen, but you can see almost a trajectory. So I guess, do you think big picture like that? And then when it comes to chorals or vocals, is it chants, is it actual words? Like what is, when somebody says chorus to you, what does that mean?
Well, it really means whatever the story sort of demands. And in this case, the voice became really, really important. And there's sort of three kind of groups or characters that are happening. There's sort of our grand choir, which is just there in those times when you need that extra oomph and grandeur, and there's plenty of those moments. But then there is one thing that we did was we took nine of our women from the big choir, and we made what I called the Phantom Princess Choir, which is we brought them into a room and they were singing together, but they were all sort of barricaded off from each other and mic'd closely, like I am now. The idea being, like, you know, usually when you record a choir, the idea is to have all these voices make a homogeneous sound and to produce something bigger than the individual voices. In this case, I wanted to do the exact opposite, which is to isolate these voices and almost have them act and lean into sort of different vocal qualities that each singer possessed. And what I wanted to do was, you know, in the film, there are these spirits of previous princesses that were sacrificed to this dragon that Elodie encounters in a dream. And are they real? Are they not real? They seem to be there. So what I wanted the score to do is that there should be this thread all the way through that they are there and they are around her. And sometimes they were there to warn her and sometimes they're there to guide her. It was an important character to me, obviously because it's a character in the film, but also, you know, to sort of emphasize one thing that Hans always says is like, you have to protect your main character. And like, you don't want the audience to kind of feel that our main character is getting herself into a situation that, you know, she's stupid to put herself into. You know, you want there to be a lingering doubt in her head. You want to be able to feel that. And there's so much that it's easy to see how she gets swept away into this fantasy herself and this own her own princess vision. But I always wanted her to have this feeling of like at the bottom of her stomach, something's not right. Something's not right. I didn't want her walking in completely naive. I wanted her to feel like somebody that we could relate to. I mean, how often do you have that feeling that something's not right and you go into it anyway and you're like, no, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Then you were proven right. So the Phantom Princess's choir, they were that for Elodie. And the other thing was the solo vocal, which starts the film, ends the film, and is there with Elodie at some of her sort of smallest moments, which were actually sung by my wife, Monica Sonnens, who also was the sort of project manager of the score. And the idea there was, and this might just be my idea, no one, it's I don't, it doesn't matter to anyone except for me, but my idea was that Elodie's main theme, like the first time you hear it, and it happens at the beginning of that track you mentioned, Elodie's Maze, is that her mother is mentioned very peripherally in the film, that she was a strong woman and she's long past, but is important to Elodie. I wanted this solo vocal. I had this idea that Elodie's theme came from a lullaby that her mother sang to her. And she's internalized it, and it now is her internal voice, and it's this thing that she has to discover within herself almost throughout this journey. You know, when I started the project, I did something like extremely foolish by the book, which is I presented the filmmakers with two themes. I said, I feel Elodie, this movie is really about her growing up, and at the beginning, she's not fully formed, and she has these two themes. She has this one representing this outward optimistic journey that she's going on, and like the best parts of her, and the parts of her that want to find herself out in the world. But then the other theme, that like Elodie's Maze theme, is that thing that she knows deep down, and the thing that she can only find by going through an inward journey and to find something inside of her, which to me is what the whole, again, I know it's a big popcorn dragon movie, but I just chose to see it in this existential way that, you know, in order to grow up, she has to go into these dark caves and confront a dragon and harness its power. And to me, that's what the film is about. And at the end, these themes finally come together, but that voice inside of her is what's always pulling her towards, like, it's a bit dark, it's not going to be fun, but in order to get to the truth, in order to find yourself, you really are going to need to go on this journey, and it's into yourself. And that's what those voices are about for me.
Well, I'm just going to pause just for a second to give you a little bit of a sitting ovation, because that's exactly what I was hoping for. Cause, you know, whether the moves you make are big or small, right or wrong, concise or drawn out. That's what you wanted. That's what you felt. And so I think if I asked that question of any other composer, I would have got a different answer. And that's exactly what I was hoping. You know, like what makes, you know, when you see something, there's an instinct. And if it's not an instinct, maybe it's technique or something. So it's like, I love it. It's beautiful. And I think that that goes a long way. And it shows that you understood the assignment, David. So great job.
Thanks. Well, you know, I was saying to somebody, it's like, you know, like maybe an actor comes with developing a backstory. And maybe it sounds wanky, but like, I think the idea there, and maybe is the same idea for me, is like whether or not it manifests itself literally on screen, that maybe it informs something that helps create a three-dimensionality to what you're doing. So at the risk of sounding pretentious, yeah, that's the goal.
Well, let's dive into more of technique and how you like to work. Because, you know, when there's a track run with the exclamation point, it's very, you know, purposely put there. And it kind of evokes intensity. It's, you know, this movie is like I came up with this last night. It's Die Hard meets Gravity via House of Dragons or something like that. But like there's this it's constantly going. And once she gets in the mix, it's like there's never really a safe spot. So you get a track that have a lot of intensity behind it. So when somebody, whether it is what you see on screen or Juan Carlos saying, hey, I need this, what does intensity mean to you? Is it volume? Is it pace? Is it, you know, is it both? Is it something else? What does intensity mean?
Yeah, it can be a lot of things. I mean, like, you know, working on Last of Us, for instance, was like every sort of episode, at least my parts of those episodes, was all about like what's a different way to express intensity. So for sure. I mean, I would say in this case, the trick with the dragon specifically, because that is sort of at least the obvious antagonist once Ellie gets in the caves. What's nice about the dragon is that it actually turns out to not be an obvious sort of baddie or villain, that it's not a mindless beast, that it has this tragic backstory. So for me, the sort of personal goal was like, even when it's a horror cue like the one you mentioned, how can it have, you know, how can its DNA still be linked to the same tragedy? So for the dragon, for instance, everything is about the number three. It's had these three children sacrificed and it's obsessed with this number. And so that number invades all the rhythms, and it also presents itself in this three note motif. So even when the dragon first breathes fire, you know, and we have the full orchestra and this ancient war horn, the Carnyx, kind of giving it this extra kind of primal, feral nature. Those three notes are still the basis of what you're hearing. Those three notes. So everything is really linked to this horrible, tragic sadness at the core, which obviously you don't find out till later. But to me, that was the challenge of, and hopefully what provided the intensity is that everything is linked to this thing in a way that the dragon and Elodie are both victims of this kingdom. And in fact, there's this one sort of sliding string figure, the ding, that happens a lot, which I use to link both Elodie and the dragon. There's this descent, you know. So for me, hopefully the intensity was coming out of that, these character things, rather than just the loud volume. Yes, it does get loud. Yes, it does get fast and intense and scary and all that, but always sort of, you know, linked to those underlying, you know, real reasons for being for both the dragon and Elodie, and then you know, just add some scary shit on top of it. And
like that James too. Horner's Aliens, just nothing right. But intensity.
Well, it was funny. Just to go off what you just mentioned is that you know, a lot of that would typically be done with sound design stuff, or at least what I've done in the past. And some of that does exist there, and I have injected it. But, you know, Juan Carlos, sometimes, like with that track you just mentioned, he always wanted to know, like, that sounds really cool, but can we get the orchestra to do this? He always wanted it to see if he always wanted to at least explore an orchestral version of that. So for some of that, it was new territory, things that I would typically do in a sound design and in a more sound design method. It was like, okay, well, if we would typically do that kind of synth here, well, what if we had the trombone sort of blast and put them through an arpeggiator and try to make use of this, of these fantastic musicians that we were playing with.
Really cool philosophy there. Cause you know, some things may not translate, and then you sort of either you set up your rules, or you kind of get your marching orders, and like, kind of falls short of, you know, whatever you are in the process. But you mentioned Warhorn earlier. So there was a really amazing track, End of Your Story. It's like the theme uncorked. It's like what you would hear in the credits when, you know, composers are like, Giacchino goes crazy in the credits. But there's this, it's a snarl or a horn or a Brahm. I can't tell, but it's like the last 30 seconds of the cue. Is that the Warhorn?
God, there's like everything in those last 30 seconds. there's probably a few things going on. I mean, there's the full orchestra. There's also right at the end where I feel Elodie really comes into her power and her themes are coming together with the dragon theme. It's also the first time that we use like electronic instruments, or electrified instruments rather. We use electric cello, electric guitar, played by Peter Gregson and Yvette Young respectively, and I liked the idea that once Elodie finally embraces her power and embraces the darkness, that there is this like almost like modern sound that all of a sudden is injected. And then the Carnyx, of course, which this, like I mentioned, this ancient war horn that used to sort of, you know, sort of as a sonic signature of the dragon when it's at its most feral and beastly. But also I think what you might be hearing is there's this bowed instrument, called a yaibahar, which is like cello strings attached to frame drums, that my old assistant, David Naroth, he built, and he actually, worked on me with one of the cues, on one of the cues for this film. And he built it out of like homemade lumber, and it's just a strange looking contraption, but when you bow it the right way, it really gives this like really nasty kind of sound. So I think that's layered in there. It's just everything in the kitchen sink is in that last, in those last few moments. So I didn't want to be accused of not using something, you know, not engaging one more layer. I don't want to be accused of restraint in any way.
Fair enough.
At that bit.
Well, you know, it's funny what you said before about you thought that the film score would going to be about subverting expectations, but there's something that I felt that was almost audiovisual counterpoint. You have sort of like an ending that is quite the comeuppance. I won't spoil it, but I think that the best that I can describe it as a face-melting heroism. And it just, it is carnage. It is thermal Wrath of God carnage, but it's heroic. And it's just a weird, you know, juxtaposition. So I think that's also part of End of Your Story too, I think. So
that's that moment.
Yeah, just a culmination. So that's another sitting ovation. I think this movie was about threes. You're going to get one more before we're done. So
there we go. I think for me, it was really about less about revenge musically and more about Elodie coming into her power and, you know, the dragon being part of that you know, being fully formed at the end, and like I said, all of those musical identities coming together, and she really is, you know, she's always the protagonist, but she really becomes the hero of the story. She becomes so much of her story is about kind of being a passenger to her circumstance. You know, she's sort of gets involved in this in the first place to please her father and her family and her kingdom and the duties that she feels. And then she becomes a princess. Okay, maybe she can be a bride. She can, this guy seems handsome. Maybe I'll go with him. Maybe this crown fits me. Maybe this dress fits me. She's sort of trying on these identities. And really, I feel that she's not fully formed until that moment when she does enact revenge. But I like to think of it more as just coming into her power, you know?
Well, it's interesting what visuals can do to, whether it's perception, intent, or just me internalizing something psychologically. You kind of get to know somebody just by kind of watching them. And I think it was well placed in the beginning that she's chopping wood, because it goes into how she, you know, she said there's not enough materials or not enough for our people. But I think that chopping wood is something that kind of, I'm rambling here, but it's something that's necessary, but it also takes some technique. And so, you know, there, when you're learning music, you know, there's, you learn a blues scale and you play things enough that it becomes second nature. So I guess, and that kind of showed that she's willing to get her hands dirty and I don't know where to go, but it's more of a compliment to you. So what is your chopping wood? What are things that you've had to do again and again to be the point where you are now the hero, you're scoring these films? What is a common thing that is both essential and time consuming to get you to be a sonic champion?
Well, I definitely don't feel like I'm there. I feel like it's still a work in progress and hopefully always will be. But I think, you know, I've been lucky enough to have a lot of experience with great filmmakers and great composers that I've worked with as well. And kind of, you know, a lot of this job is problem solving, and when you've been around enough problems, you at least can recognize them when they come along to know at least how in trouble you are, you know, and you've seen this before, or you've seen how you've solved this before, or someone else did, and you know, being in those rooms with Hans or Atli Orvison or Steve Jablonski, you know, it was also like a quick way to be in rooms with really, really great filmmakers and see how they approach music and everything. So you know, my process continues to be like a struggle. It's never easy on every project. I have senses of this is all going to collapse, and thankfully it never really has. It seems to be part of my process, but you know, it's just to me the best thing is just to continue working with really talented people as much as possible. And every time I do, I learn something. And I've lost all experience at doing manual labor like chopping wood. So I'd be lost in that situation. But no, yeah, Elodie does it really well. That's an interesting parallel you bring up. And I never really thought about the wood chopping, but it is a great introduction and it's a nice pickup.
It's, I'm always trying to find a way to tie things into Rocky IV, chopping wood, running up a hill, top of a mountain, screaming Drago. So yeah. Well, let's have some fun, David. What I love about this movie is this was probably unintentional, but I have to credit just the subtitles. Every time the dragon would say Elodie, he would stretch her name out. It would be Elodie. And when you see that in subtitles, it would be L-O-Die. And I just found that funny. It's not purposeful. I mean, it's just a random coincidence, but just seeing L-O die, it's right. I think she's like running away from death. I don't know. So that's something I found funny about it. What was fun to you about the project? What do you find not necessarily funny about this movie, but like, how do you find humor in unexpected places? And what makes you laugh?
Oh, what makes me laugh? I mean, right now my son is making me laugh constantly because he's hilarious, and he's got the same attraction to like super dramatic musical things. Like right now, he's obsessed with In the Hall of the Mountain King, you know, the piece. Dun, 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 dun. And he's just constantly singing it and is absolutely obsessed. What made me laugh on this project? I mean, honestly, it was a lot of fun, and I had a fantastic team. You know, it was getting to really. It's funny, me and my wife worked together on this one. We've worked together a couple times in the past. We met working together for a composer, and then we worked together again during Blue Planet, where she was running that project. And since then, I worked with Hans a lot. She worked with Ludvig Göransson a lot, and this was our first sort of project coming back together. So that was really. That was amazing, and that was so much fun. And we had a great team working on it. Jake Boring, who works with me, and Monica brought in Felipe Pacheco as a music editor. And I think going to London with all of them was a really great time. And I'm bringing it back to my son again, because we brought him to London as well, and he came to watch the orchestra. And it was pretty great, because it was that we brought him into the booth, and everyone was excited to see him in the booth, and oh, it's cute kid. But he had just learned about green light, red light, and like red means stop and green means go. And the issue is, we brought him into the booth, and every time they start recording, the red light comes on. So every time they would start recording, he started to go, stop. And so, like, we had to get him out of the booth pretty quickly. that wore its welcome pretty fast. But no, it was great. It was a great time. It was. I think getting into embrace that melodic thing sort of set a tone for the project. And of course, it had stressful moments. And of course, I'm glazing over all of those times. But what you tend to remember at the end of these projects is. You have the outcome, and then you have the best moments. You have the times getting to hear an incredibly talented orchestra play the music for the first time. And I get so sick. I've actually retired the phrase "had a blast," because I've gotten so sick of like seeing composers and other creatives like, that's the standard Instagram post. Had a blast. It's like, no, you didn't. You probably didn't. But I this was one of the like, honestly, the best times of my life, getting to work on this film. It was really, really special time for me.
Well, one of the questions I like to ask towards the end of an interview is, what's your victory dance, whether it's getting a cue approved, or, you know, seeing the symphony, or seeing the live players nail what you wrote, or just watching it in the theater? Like, yes, we've crossed the bridge. We've finished this. Like, what's your happy dance?
I let myself celebrate so infrequently that people are constantly like, aren't you happy you got all those cues approved? I until it's finally done, I usually don't celebrate that much. And then to the point where once it's finally done, it's so anticlimactic, because I'm like, oh, that was the last revision. Now it's done. You know, there's no, however, like, what do I actually do? I usually go get some food that's really bad for me. Like, I'll go like get Taco Bell or Wendy's, and like that, like, if I'm feeling good about myself, I'll do something terrible to myself like that.
Well,
which, by the way, is the same answer. If things go really badly, I'll also go get Taco Bell or Wendy's. So those, okay. It exists on those two sides of the spectrum.
Well, I was going to say, as a way to celebrate and tell you how much I appreciate your work, I was going to send you a chalupa, but then that might confuse the message, because it'd be like, did he like it or did he not like it? So
it's always good. That's what's good about it. It's the great equalizer. It's there in the good times and bad times.
Well, one more question for you. This is a question my friend loves to ask. What's the most curious soundtrack in your collection, or curious record that, like, if somebody comes over, it has a story behind it, you love it for X reason? Do you got anything laying around?
Oh, I know I have a lot. I know I have a lot. I'm thinking about our record collection. I mean, the composer I've been sort of fixated on for the past couple years is Moondog. It was sort of this really interesting composer who kind of spanned jazz and symphonic music, and he lived on the streets in New York for a lot of his life, and dressed like a Viking, and you know, there's so much visually that's interesting about him, but even without all those visuals, the music is so. The first time I heard it, it accidentally ended up on my iPod at that time somehow, and I thought it was something really modern. I thought it was something new, but it was from the '60s, and that's a composer whose music is always very different and really inspiring. And there's no specific story other than I love it and it's great. And now he's the middle name namesake for my son. Moondog is one of his middle names. So yeah.
Well, both that story and affectionate little tie-in there, that gives you your third round of applause, bringing the trio of notes and sonic.
All right. There we
principalities
go.
Together. David Fleming, everybody, thank you for your time. We wish him the best. Let him get on to his next project. So until that time, we will catch you next time.